Clive Price now digs into the history of the Goyt Valley with Les Meadowcroft and Joe Hewitt, who remembers when it was lonely down below.
The bonny pitladdy, the canny pitladdy, the bonny pitladdy for me, oh. He sits on his cracket as black as his jacket and brings waste a letter me, oh.
In winter, the Goyt Valley is a wild and desolate area. The twin reservoirs of Fernilly and Erwood are cradled by forbidding, windswept moors where the birds are the only residents. The valley itself is deserted, but there was a time when it was home to a thriving community, as Les Meadowcroft recalls.
My earliest memories are in the very early 1930s, when an uncle of mine, who was a very keen walker, took me out for my second walk, and he took me up the Goyt Valley, and he told me at the time, he said, "Leslie, I'm taking you up the Goyt Valley because very soon it's going to be spoiled." He says, "They're going to build a reservoir, and I want you to see it before the engineers get to work." And I was only round about 8 at the time, and we went to Whaley Bridge by the train, and we walked right through the valley up to Buxton, and he was pointing out various places of interest: the Goyt Bridge, the old powder mills, and various points of interest for me to put into my memory store. Well, the next time we went along, the Fernley Reservoir had just been opened. And, of course, various things had been submerged. And, of course, as you know, later on in years, the other reservoir, the Erwood, was built. Now, the Packhorse Bridge was removed stone by stone from its site at the bottom of Goyt Lane and rebuilt further up the valley, where it stands today, just beyond the site where at one time there used to be a youth hostel in some stone cottages.
But now the stone cottages have vanished. The only visible reminder of the days when the valley was inhabited are the crumbling ruins of Erwood Hall itself. The life of those far-off days is clearly etched in the memory of Joe Hewitt, who first went to live in the Goyt Valley when he was 10 years old.
We were invited here by the owners of the estate, well, my father, to reopen the mine, which is known as Cast Edge. It may come as rather a surprise to a lot of people to know that there was, in fact, a mine in the Goyt Valley. Oh, yes, well, of course, it would be... It's roughly 1,700-1,800 yards in from the surface, and mining must have been going on in this little spot for quite a number of years. Whether it was opened by the Grimshaw family or not, I wouldn't know. But without any question of doubt, it was here and been here for a long time, and of course so had the Grimshaw family. We're standing right by the entrance here, or what used to be the entrance. It's now blocked in. How far in did it go, and what was it like inside?
There's what is termed to be a cross measures tunnel running for about 100 yards from where we're standing, and then we would bear sharp left. In other words, we would strike the coal on the rise and then turn left with the coal and mine from the rise side, as it were, that is, down towards the main roadway. The height of the roadway would be no more than about 4 feet in any place, unless one had had a fall, and really you sort of more or less went in and out at the back of the wagon on your hands and knees. As a boy, it used to take me from leaving the coal face, as it were, to coming outside, emptying by hand 500 weights of coal and going back again, roughly about three quarters of an hour. We'd used to do about, if I said six tubs with coal between us in the day, that would be the sum total of the output. We had to make sure that the Erwood Hall had enough coal for their requirements. We also supplied the farms on the estate with coal. We used to get 12 and 6 per ton for the coal put into the Erwood Hall coal place, but it wasn't all that bad because there was a jug of beer kept filled for every time you went. So you went to quite often and you saw the place was well and truly stacked up. From there on, we sold surplus coal to outside farmers from as far as Wildboar Clough and places like that. They used to come for about 5 or 10 hundred weights. There wasn't a lot of cash transactions. More often it was in exchange for milk or butter or eggs or cheese. And that was the way that it went. And these farmers used to make a day of getting perhaps 5 or 10 hundred weights of coal from this little pit. It was a wonderful life, really, because in the summertime, people didn't use as much coal, and consequently, instead of going in the mine, we'd spend the day outside doing a few repairs and sharpening a few picks and that sort of thing. And then, of course, we'd black our faces a bit, go down home. My mother thought we'd been working, and that was it for our day, that particular day.
Over on the far bank of the stream, there are the remains of the old hut in which you, in fact, did work.
Oh, yes, yes. That was where we had the smithy for sharpening picks and wedges and keeping the three pit tubs that we had in repair. We had a circular saw bench to cut the timber to out of the wood above to make boards and frames for the for the wagons.
Did you use pit props as well?
Oh yes, we went up into the wood for one when we wanted one.
So you had all your equipment on hand, as it were?
As it were, except once when a new inspector came and dropped on us rather unexpectedly, and he was waiting here for me when I came out of the pit, and he said, doesn't seem to be much in the way of pit props lying about. Where do you get them from? I said, well, my father tells me if he wants a couple, and when I come out, I get the saw and go up into the wood and cut a couple to length, and I take them back. So I'm afraid this didn't suit our friend, the inspector, very much. He said, what if he needed the prop before I got back again? I said, well, I wouldn't know, but from there on, I had to keep a few props in hand, and he even made us make out a report book, a statutory report book for the two of us. And really, I ask you how far people can go in making you do things that really aren't necessary in a case like this. The inspector that we'd had before, he used to come with his wife and used to come when the rhododendrons were out and have tea and ask how things were. And, that was it, a nice afternoon's out. But when he retired and put the new one on, it was an entirely different kettle of fish. We had to pull our socks up.
What sort of coal did you get out of here?
Well, it was known, really, as a caking coal. In other words, you put it on the fire and it caked, and then you had to allow it to cake and ease it with the poker, and then you had a wonderful fire. It was a very good coal, really, insomuch as, apart from the household usage, it was used far and wide within the district by the blacksmiths for welding and general forge work, and really recognized as something that couldn't be beaten.
for that particular purpose. How old were you when you actually started working in the mine itself?
Oh, well, 13 perhaps. 12 or 13, you know, I could get coal. It was longwall, known as longwall work. You, in other words, you lay down to get the coal. You had the roadway, which was the main roadway known as the level at the foot of the seam. From there on, you would take what would be known as a gate to the rise side, and this would be taken up for 60 yards or so. And that stretch of mining was done with a sledge and a belt and chain, so that you had a belt around your waist and a chain to the sledge, and you pulled it up, assuming you were right up to the top of it. That held about 2,500 weights of coal. You brought it down, tipped it up, and then went up again, and twice that, of course, made a tub of coal, about 500 weights.
That was quite heavy work.
Oh, yes, quite heavy work, but, you know, you got used to it. It used to be a great day when some of the people, some of the young visitors came to Erwood Hall, and we'd line, they'd want to go and get a bit of coal. And we'd get these young ladies and young gentlemen coming along and line a pit tub with. They'd bring, you know, blankets and things. And they had to lie down in the tub because the roof was so near the top of the tub. And you'd take them in, and my goodness me, they'd crawl away right up to the coal face and give them a pick, and they'd get a little cobble of coal. It used to be wrapped in a handkerchief, and that was great, and great for ourselves too, because I'd get a pound.
After you'd dragged the sledge down with the coal, you then had to load it into the tub and then pull it all the way to the entrance, more than a mile.
More than a mile, yes. It was, time really meant nothing to us in this district. They used to ring the bell, the Angelus it was called, and it they were never to half an hour with it anyway. And it used to ring in the morning, I think it was about six. And then it would ring again about nine, which I think was breakfast time. And then it would ring again at 12. That was time to have some lunch. Rang again about 4:30. I think that was the tea time within the hall. Rang again, would it be at 6, and then at 9, and that 9 in the evening, that was it.
What time did you start work in the morning?
10.
That's rather late.
It was near enough up here, sir. Plenty near enough. Around 10 in the morning, and we'd go and do a stint of 4 or 6 tubs of coal. And when we'd done that, we'd be out, irrespective of the time.
Did you actually take your meals into the mine with you?
Oh, yes, yes. A bottle of cold tea and a few cheese sandwiches.
As you took the coal out, what did you do with the waste?
You packed it behind you, and as you took out, say, the thickness of the seam, the waste would be thrown behind you so for the roof to settle on at a later date. What sort of happens in mining is that if you work it right, the coal face talks to you. In other words, it crackles away. You work it on what they call the board of the coal, that is the smooth surface of the coal. And as you're picking away there, it's crackling away and talking to you. That's when things are working nicely and your coal will come easily. After you'd done, perhaps, after you'd extracted a fairly large area of the coal, of course, there's no prop in the world will hold the roof. What you get is a gradual bend on the thing until, at a later date, it breaks its back, as it were, and you get then what is known as a weight. And then, of course, when that happens,
Well, you get out of the way and don't do any more that day, and then the next day you'll see where it's all settled down onto your packs, and you're away again then.
Did you not find this all rather frightening as a small boy?
Oh, first time, yes, but not afterwards, you sort of knew. A prop would crack or something, and you'd hear things happening in the roof, and you'd sort of get out of it. You'd plenty of time.
How long did you yourself stay here?
Well, we came in two parts, actually. We came about around about the 1920 first time, and we were here about 6 or 7 years. And then my father's previous employer, Mr. Knowles, the owner of the Furnace Vale Colliery, persuaded him to go and manage his mine for him. And after not so long missing out on the good time that we had on this estate, we decided to come back again, and the Grimshaw family were more than happy to sort of have us back. And from there on, we ran the mine until the Stockport Corporation took on the estate, and that finalised the issue.
The bonny Pitladdy, the canny Pitladdy, the bonny Pitladdy for me, oh. He sits on his cracket as black as his jacket and brings weights a lot to me, oh.
You were living here, in fact, before you actually started work in the mines.
Yes.
Did you go to school in the valley?
Oh, yes, the own private school. The estate provided a school at the bottom of the drive. It was a timber-built hut, actually, but a fully qualified teacher. And Mrs. Rourke was the name. And there'd be about 10 or 12 children attend the school. She did the lot. She trained us from quite the young ones to the time of leaving school. The three R's were the main thing to do. And she was a very strict person and very, very good at the job, and I think she turned out some very good children.
Did the school stand where the new reservoir now is?
It's submerged. If ever anyone remembered the gates to the entrance of the estate, the school was no more than 50 yards up the Erwood Drive on the left.
Didn't you act as a footman on many of an occasion?
Oh, yes, as a boy, with being rather on the tall side, if they were short of a footman, they would send down to the school for me, and I would go up to the hall, and they'd fix me up with a liveried coat that came down to my heels. They'd pack a hat with a newspaper so that it didn't fall over my ears. And one had to get onto the coach with the coachman and full regalia to either Buxton or Whaley Bridge Station. You had to look straight ahead whilst the owners were in the carriage. It was quite a good view coming back. Oh, yes, on many occasions. Actually, before I went to school, I used to go to Erwood Hall. It was all lit with the oil lamps, and I used to clean the lamps, fill them with paraffin, trim the wicks, clean the ladies' shoes, and have my breakfast, and then I'd go to school. And if you didn't make quite so good a job of any of the ladies' shoes, they sent the coachman down specially. Sent the coachman down specially to school, and you had to go up and do them again. For that, I got 3 and 6 pence per week,
which was quite a lot of money.
Quite a lot of money in those days, plus my breakfast. plus my dinner on a Saturday, because I used to help the butler to clean the silver and mop the passages.
The Elwoods had some connections with Manchester, didn't they?
Yes. I was given to understand that Elwood Park, in the days gone by, was part of the estate, and Low Mosley Street and that area again was land belonging to the Grimshaw family.
Where did they make their money?
Shipping, I'm given to understand. They had their own yacht, and they must have been quite big in their way, because it was always said on the estate that they fired the royal salute for one of the kings of Spain's weddings in that day, so they must have been somebody sometimes.
We're standing above the stream that runs by the mine entrance, and down there is the remnants, part of the engine, of an old car. Now, you know something about this, don't you?
Oh, that was the old Ford T model that we used to carry coal to Wood Hall in. A year or two before the estate finally closed down, there was an almighty flood that washed the old motor. It was a sort of a small wagon affair. Washed the old motor down the stream, and of course it wasn't worth recovering at all, but over the years since then, people seem to have taken it away bit by bit. But it's the old motor that we used to carry coal with to Elwood Hall.
And how far is it from the mine entrance to the hall?
Half a mile.
And how did you get the coal up there before you had this car?
Oh, horse and cart.
So you had a horse down here as well?
Oh, yes, in the little cabin.
Joe, we're now standing on the edge of Shooter's Clough, and we have a wall area that's more or less completely overgrown with bracken. What was this when you lived up here?
Oh, that was the kitchen garden. It was a greenhouse here, and it was the kitchen garden for Elwood Hall.
And the house in which you lived was at the far end?
That's right, that was Shooter's Clough. That was originally the residence of a gamekeeper, but the gamekeeper moved up near Cat and Fiddle, and this house was vacant, and this is how they sort of fixed us with a house quite near to the mine. There are two things, really, about Shooter's Clough. One thing is that the poachers used to spend an awful lot of time here, and up the wood side up there, they frightened us to death when first we came, but there was really no need to worry, it was only rabbits they were after. But they used to set, they tell me, a 200-yard net up the edge of that wood, and drive the rabbits in from the Pimchair side, and I'm given to understand that they could have as many rabbits as yards of net. They come quite frequently, and there would be a lot of noise whilst they were there, but when we got used to it, you go to sleep and take no notice. Actually, we never locked a door up here, do you know? On the bank side here, between Shooter's Clough and Castage, during the winter time, when we had the snows, we used to toboggan down there. The servants from Wood Hall would, a nice bright moonlight night, and they'd leave the housekeeper in, probably with the owners, and there'd be, if I said, 20 of us all together, tobogganing down there till the early hours of the morning, and they had to be up early, and probably they'd go straight to work at 6 o'clock. A wonderful time. On and on it used to go in the moonlight, tobogganing down there. Lovely.
You were telling me that one of the fireplaces in Elwood Hall held a tremendous amount of coal.
About 500 weights, I'm told. They had a huge spit arrangement that used to go round in front of the fireplace, and a huge sort of joint of beef going round and round for how long, I don't know. I know it used to produce an awful lot of dripping, and the dripping used to be put in 7-pound jars and handed around to tenants around the estate, and really it was wonderful.
Approximately how many people used to live on the estate in those days?
Well, I would think there'd be a staff of around 20.
How many farms were there in the Goyt Valley in those days?
Oh, I should say a dozen.
Yeah. All with families living on them?
All with families living on them. All coming twice a year to a rent dinner. They didn't pay very much rent. I think the dinner was probably worth more than, cost more than they paid in rent. But twice a year they used to come to Erwin Hall to pay the rent. And in at the payment was a really good meal.
And what sort of things did they have at this meal?
Well, it would be a cooked meal. You're asking me really more than I can tell you, but they had their own French chef. Surely you'd have an idea that it would be a meal of variety and drink to go with it. Take them round the floor in the Spanish custom of dancing, and that was their bit for the evening. And from there on, it would wind up in the end, and everybody would have hot whiskey punch, hamper under their arm to take home. The hamper would contain chickens, grouse, a turkey or something. Really a very nice hamper, and really a wonderful place to live.
Lonely Down Below was presented by Clive Price.